fine blade was wasted on a mere headsman. He gave Sir Ilion a new sword, and had ice melted down and reforged. There was enough metal for 2 new blades. You're holding 1. So you'll be defending Ned Stark's daughter with Ned Stark's own steel, if that makes any difference to you. Sir, I owe you an apology. He cut her off. Take the bloody sword and go, before I change my mind. There's a bay mare in the stables, as homely as you are, but somewhat better trained. Chase after Steelshanks, search for Sansa, or ride home to your Isle of Sapphires. It's naught to me. I don't want to look at you any more. Jaime, Kingslayer, he reminded her. Best use that sword to clean the wax out of your ears, wench. We're done. Stubbornly she persisted. Joffrey was my king. Leave it at that. You say Sansa killed him? Why protect her? Because Joff was no more to me than a squirt of seed in Cersei's cunt, and because he deserved to die. I have made kings and unmade them. Sansa Stark is my last chance for honour. Jaime smiled thinly. Besides, kingslayers should band together. Are you ever going to go? Her big hand wrapped tight around Oathkeeper. I will. And I will find the girl and keep her safe, for her Lady Mother's sake, and for yours. She bowed stiffly, whirled, and went. Jaime sat alone at the table, while the shadows crept across the room. As dusk began to settle, he lit a candle and opened the white book to his own page. Quill and ink he found in a drawer. Beneath the last line Sir Barristan had entered, he wrote in an awkward hand that might have done credit to a 6-year-old being taught his first letters by a maester. Defeated in the Whispering Wood by young wolf Robb Stark during the War of the 5 Kings, held captive at River Run and ransomed for a promise unfulfilled, captured again by the brave companions and maimed at the word of Vargo Hoat, their captain, losing his sword hand to the blade of Zolo the Fat, return safely to King's Landing by Brienne, the Maid of Tarth. When he was done, more than 3/4 of his page still remained to be filled between the gold lion on the crimson shield on top and the blank white shield at the bottom. Sir Gerald Hightower had begun his history, and Sir Barristan Selmy had continued it. But the rest Jaime Lannister would need to write for himself. He could write whatever he chose henceforth, whatever he chose.
This is Roy Dotrice. We hope you've enjoyed this production of A Game of Thrones, A Song of Fire and Ice, Book 1, by George R. R. Martin.
John. The wind was blowing wild from the east, so strong the heavy cage would rock whenever a gust got it in its teeth. It skirled along the wall, shivering off the ice, making John's cloak flap against the bars. The sky was slate grey, the sun no more than a faint patch of brightness behind the clouds. Across the killing ground he could see the glimmer of 1,000 campfires burning, but their light seemed small and powerless against such gloom and cold. A grim day. Jon Snow wrapped gloved hands around the bars and held tight as the wind hammered at the cage once more. When he looked straight down past his feet, the ground was lost in shadow, as if he were being lowered into some bottomless pit. Well, death is a bottomless pit, of sorts, he reflected, and when this day's work is done, my name will be shadowed for ever. Bastard children were born from lust and lies, men said. Their nature was wanton and treacherous. Once John had meant to prove them wrong, to show his Lord Father that he could be as good and true a son as Rob. I made a botch of that. Rob had become a hero king. If John was remembered at all, it would be as a turncloak, an oathbreaker, and a murderer. He was glad that Lord Eddard was not alive to see his shame. I should have stayed in that cave with regret. If there was a life beyond this one, he hoped to tell her that. She will claw my face the way the eagle did and curse me for a coward, but I'll tell her all the same. He flexed his sword hand, as Maester Aemon had taught him. The habit had become part of him, and he would need his fingers to be limber to have even half a chance of murdering Mance Raider. They had pulled him out this morning, after 4 days in the ice, locked up in a cell, 5 by 5 by 5, too low for him to stand, too tight for him to stretch out on his back. The stewards had long ago discovered that food and meat kept longer in the icy storerooms carved from the base of the wall, but prisoners did not. "You will die in here, Lord Snow," Sir Alistair had said just before he closed the heavy wooden door, and John had believed it. But this morning they had come and pulled him out again, and marched him, cramped and shivering, back to the King's Tower, to stand before jowly Jaina Slint once more.
"That old maester says I cannot hang you," Slint declared. "He has written Cutter Pike, and even had the bloody gall to show me the letter. He says you are no turncloak."
"Aemons lived too long, my lord," Sir Alistair assured him. "His wits have gone dark as his eyes."
"Aye," Slint said, "a blind man with a chain about his neck. Who does he think he is?"
"Aemon Targaryen," John thought. "A king's son, and a king's brother, and a king who might have been." But he said nothing.
"Still," Slint said, "I will not have it said that Jaina Slint hanged a man unjustly. I will not. I have decided to give you one last chance to prove you are as loyal as you claim, Lord Snow. One last chance to do your duty, yes?"
He stood.
"Mance Raider wants to parley with us. He knows he has no chance now that Jaina Slint has come, so he wants to talk. This king beyond the wall. But the man is craven, and he will not come to us. No doubt he knows I'll hang him. Hang him by his feet, from the top of the wall on a rope 200 feet long. But he will not come. He asks that we send an envoy to him."
"We're sending you, Lord Snow," Sir Alistair smiled. "Me?" John's voice was flat. "Why me?"
"You rode with his wildlings," said Thorne. "Mance Raider knows you. He will be more inclined to trust you."
That was so wrong, John might have laughed. "You've got it backwards. Man suspected me from the first. If I showed up in his camp, wearing a black cloak again, and speaking for the night's watch, he'll know that I betrayed him."
"He asked for an envoy. We're sending one," said Slint. "If you are too craven to face this turncloak king, we can return you to your ice cell. This time without the furs, I think. Yes?"
"No need for that, my lord," said Sir Alistair.
"Lord Snow will do as we ask. He wants to show us that he's no turncloak. He wants to prove himself a loyal man of the Night's Watch."
Thorne was much the more clever of the two, John realized. This had his stink all over it. He was trapped. "I'll go," he said, in a clipped, curt voice.
"My lord,"
Jaina Slint reminded him,
"you'll address me."
"I'll go, my lord, but you are making a mistake," my lord. You are sending the wrong man, my lord. Just a sight of me is going to anger Mance. My lord would have a better chance of reaching terms if he sent...
Terms? Sir Alistair chuckled. Janus Slint does not make terms with lawless savages, Lord Snow. No, he does not.
We're not sending you to talk with Mance Rayder, Sir Alistair said. We're sending you to kill him. The wind whistled through the bars, and Jon Snow shivered. His leg was throbbing, and his head. He was not fit to kill a kitten, yet here he was. The trap had teeth. With Maester Aemon insisting on John's innocence, Lord Janus had not dared to leave him in the ice to die. This was better. Our honour means no more than our lives, so long as the realm is safe, Carn Halfhand had said in the Frostfangs. He must remember that. Whether he slew Mance, or only tried and failed, the free folk would kill him. Even desertion was impossible, if he'd been so inclined. To Mance he was a proven liar and betrayer. When the cage jerked to a halt, John swung down onto the ground and rattled Longclaw's hilt to loosen the bastard blade in its scabbard. The gate was a few yards to his left, still blocked by the splintered ruins of the turtle, the carcass of a mammoth ripening within. There were other corpses, too, strewn amidst broken barrels, hardened pitch, and patches of burnt grass, all shadowed by the wall. John had no wish to linger here. He started walking toward the wildling camp, past the body of a dead giant whose head had been crushed by a stone. A raven was pulling out bits of brain from the giant's shattered skull. It looked up as he walked by.
"Snow!"
it screamed at him.
"Snow! Snow!"
Then it opened its wings and flew away. No sooner had he started out than a lone rider emerged from the wildling camp and came toward him. He wondered if Mance was coming out to parley in No Man's Land. That might make it easier, though nothing will make it easy. But as the distance between them diminished, John saw that the horseman was short and broad, with gold rings glinting on thick arms and a white beard spreading out across his massive chest.
"Har!"
Tormund boomed when they came together.
"Jon Snow, the crow! I feared we'd seen the last of you."
"I never knew you feared anything, Tormund." That made the wildling grin.
"Well said, lad. I see your cloak is black. Mance won't like that. If you've come to change sides again, best climb back on that wall of yours."
"They've sent me to treat with the king beyond the wall."
"Treat?" Tormund laughed. "Now, there's a word. Mance wants to talk. That's true enough. Can't say he'll want to talk with you, though."
"I'm the one they've sent."
"I see that. Best come along, then. You want to ride?"
"I can walk."
"Your fort is hard here."
Tormund turned his garron back towards the wildling camp.
"You and your brothers, I'll give you that. 200 dead and a dozen giants. Mag himself went in that gate of yours and never did come out."
"He died on the sword of a brave man named Donal Noy."
"Aye, some great lord was he, this Donal Noy. One of your shiny knights in their steel small clothes."
"A blacksmith. He only had one arm."
"A one-armed smith? Slew Mag the Mighty? That must have been a fight to see. Mance will make a song of it, see if he don't."
Tormund took a water skin off his saddle and pulled the cork.
"This will warm us some. To Donal Noy and Mag the Mighty."
He took a swig and handed it down to John. "To Donal Noy and Mag the Mighty." The skin was full of mead, but a mead so potent that it made John's eyes water and sent tendrils of fire snaking through his chest. After the ice cell and the cold ride down in the cage, the warmth was welcome. Tormund took the skin back and downed another swig, then wiped his mouth.
"The Magnar of Sen swore to us that he'd have the gate wide open, so all we'd need to do was stroll through singing. He was going to bring the whole wall down.
He brought down part, said John, on his head.
Ha ha! Said Tormund. Well, I never had much use for stir. When a man's got no beard, no hair, no ears, you can't get a good grip on him when you fight.
He kept his horse at a slow walk, so John could limp beside him.
What happened to that leg?
An arrow. One of regrets, I think.
That's a woman for you. One day she's kissing you, the next she's filling you with adders.
She's dead.
Aye?
Tormund gave a sad shake of the head.
A waste. If I'd been 10 years younger, I'd have stolen her myself. That air she had, oh, well, the hottest fires burn out quickest.
He lifted the skin of mead.
To regret, kiss by fire.
He drank deep. To regret, kiss by fire, John repeated when Tormund handed him back the skin. He drank even deeper.
Was it you killed her?
My brother. John had never learned which one, and hoped he never would.
You bloody crows!
Tormund's tone was gruff, yet strangely gentle.
That long spear stole me daughter, Munda, me little autumn apple. Took her right out of me tent, with all four of her brothers about. Torrig slept through it, the great lout, and Torwin, well, Torwin the tame, that says all it needs saying. Don't it? The young ones gave the lad a fight, though.
And Munda? Asked John.
She's me own blood, said Tormund proudly. She broke his lip for him and bit one ear half off, and I hear he's got so many scratches on his back he can't wear a cloak. She likes him well enough, though. And why not? He don't fight with no spear, you know. Never has. So where do you think he got that name? Eh?
John had to laugh. Even now, even here. Ygritte had been fond of Longspear Rick. He hoped he'd found some joy with Tormund's Munda. Someone needed to find some joy somewhere. You know nothing, John Snow, Ygritte would have told him. I know that I'm going to die, he thought. I know that much at least.
All men die, he could almost hear her say. And women, too, and every beast that flies, or swims, or runs. It's not the when of dying that matters. It's the how of it, John Snow.
Easy for you to say, he thought back. You died brave in battle, storming the castle of a foe. I'm going to die a turncloak and a killer. Nor would his death be quick, unless it came on the end of Mansa's sword. Soon they were among the tents. It was the usual wildling camp, a sprawling jumble of cook fires and piss pits, children and goats wandering freely, sheep bleating among the trees, horse hides pegged up to dry. There was no plan to it, no order, no defences, but there were men and women and animals everywhere. Many ignored him, but for everyone who went about his business, there were 10 who stopped to stare. Children squatting by the fires, old women in dog carts, cave dwellers with painted faces, raiders with claws and snakes and severed heads painted on their shields, all turned to have a look. John saw spear wives, too, their long hair streaming in the piney wind that sighed between the trees. There were no true hills here, but Manse Raider's white fur tent had been raised on a spot of high stony ground right on the edge of the trees. The king beyond the wall was waiting outside, his ragged red and black cloak blowing in the wind. Harmer Dogshead was with him, John saw, back from her raids and feints along the wall. And Varamyr Sixskins as well, attended by his shadow cat and 2 lean grey wolves. When they saw who the watch had sent, Harmer turned her head and spat, and one of Varamyr's wolves bared its teeth and growled.
You must be very brave or very stupid, John Snow,
Manse Raider said,
to come back to us wearing a black cloak.
What else would a man of the Night's Watch wear? "Kill him," urged Harmer. "Send his body back up in that cage of theirs, and tell them to send us someone else. I'll keep his head for my standard. A turncoat's worse than a dog."
"I warned you he was false." Vladimir's tone was mild, but his shadow cat was staring at John hungrily through slitted grey eyes. "I never did like the smell of him."
"Pull in your claws, beastling."
Tormund Giantsbane swung down off his horse.
"The lad's here to hear. You lay a paw on him. Might be I'll take that shadow skin cloak I've been wanting." "Tormund Crow Lover,"
Harmer sneered.
"You are a great sack of wind, old man."
The skin changer was grey faced, round shouldered, and bald, a mouse of a man with a wolfling's eyes.
"Once a horse is broken to the saddle, any man can mount him," he said in a soft voice. "Once a beast's been joined to a man, any skin changer can slip inside and ride him. Orel was withering inside his feathers, so I took the eagle for my own. But the joining works both ways, Warg. Orel lives inside me now, whispering how much he hates you, and I can soar above the wall and see with eagle eyes."
"So we know," said Mance. "We know how few you were when you stopped the turtle. We know how many came from Eastwatch. We know how your supplies have dwindled. Pitch, oil, arrows, spears. Even your stare is gone. And that cage can only lift so many. We know. And now you know we know."
He opened the flap of his tent. "Come inside. The rest of you wait here."
"What, even me?" said Tormund.
"Particularly you, always."
It was warm within. A small fire burned beneath the smoke holes, and a brazier smouldered near the pile of furs, where Darla lay, pale and sweating. Her sister was holding her hand. Val, John remembered. "I was sorry when Jarl fell," he told her. Val looked at him with pale grey eyes.
"He always climbed too fast."
She was as fair as he remembered, slender, full-breasted, graceful, even at rest, with high, sharp cheekbones and a thick braid of honey-coloured hair that fell to her waist.
"Dallas Tame is near," Mance explained. "She and Val will stay. They know what I mean to say."
John kept his face as still as ice. Foul enough to slay a man in his own tent under truce. Must I murder him in front of his wife as their child is being born? He closed the fingers of his sword hand. Mance was not wearing armour, but his own sword was sheathed on his left hip. And there were other weapons in the tent, daggers and dirks, a bow and a quiver of arrows, a bronze-headed spear lying beside that big black horn. John sucked in his breath.
A war horn, a bloody great war horn.
"Yes," Mance said, "the horn of winter, that Joramun once blew to wake giants from the earth."
The horn was huge, 8 feet along the curve and so wide at the mouth that he could have put his arm inside up to the elbow. If this came from an oryx, it was the biggest that ever lived. At first he thought the bands around it were bronze, but when he moved closer, he realized they were gold. Old gold, more brown than yellow, and graven with runes. "Ygritte said you never found the horn."
"Did you think only crows could lay? I liked you well enough for a bastard, but I never trusted you. A man needs to earn my trust."
John faced him. "If you've had the horn of Joramun all along, why haven't you used it? Why bother building turtles and sending thens to kill us in our beds? If this horn is all the songs say, why not just sound it and be done?" It was Darla who answered him. Darla, great with child, lying on her pile of furs beside the brazier.
"We free folk know things you kneelers have forgotten.
Sometimes the short road is not the safest, Jon Snow. The Horn Lord once said that sorcery is a sword without a hilt. There is no safe way to grasp it.
Mance ran a hand along the curve of the great horn. No man goes hunting with only one arrow in his quiver, he said. I had hoped that Stir and Jarl would take your brothers unawares and open the gate for us. I drew your garrison away with feints and raids and secondary attacks. Bournemarsh swallowed that lure, as I knew he would, but your band of cripples and orphans proved to be more stubborn than anticipated. Don't think you've stopped us, though. The truth is, you're too few and we are too many.
I could continue the attack here, and still send 10,000 men to cross the Bay of Seals on rafts, and take Eastwatch from the rear. I could storm the Shadow Tower, too. I know the approaches as well as any man alive. I could send men and mammoths to dig out the gates of the castles you've abandoned, all of them at once.
Why don't you, then? John could have drawn Longclaw then, but he wanted to hear what the wildling had to say.
Blood, said Mance Rayder. I'd win in the end, yes, but you'd bleed me, and my people have bled enough.
Your losses haven't been that heavy.
Not at your hands.
Mance studied John's face.
You saw the fists of the first men. You know what happened there. You know what we are facing.
The others?
Yeah, they grow stronger as the days grow shorter and the nights colder. First they kill you, then they send your dead against you. The giants have not been able to stand against them, nor the Thens, the Ice River clans, the Hornfoots.
Nor you?
Nor me.
There was anger in that admission, and bitterness too deep for words.
Raymond Redbeard, Bale the Bard, Gendel and Gorn, the Horn Lord, they all came south to conquer. But I've come with my tail between my legs to hide behind your wall.
He touched the horn again.
If I sound the horn of winter, the wall will fall, or so the songs would have me believe. There are those among my people who want nothing more.
But once the wall is fallen, Dalla said, what will stop the others?
Mance gave her a fond smile.
It's a wise woman I found, a true queen.
He turned back to John. Go back and tell them to open their gate and let us pass. If they do, I will give them the horn, and the wall will stand until the end of days.
Open the gate and let them pass.
Easy to say, but what must follow? Giants camping in the ruins of Winterfell? Cannibals in the Wolfswood? Chariots sweeping across the Barrowlands? Free folk stealing daughters of shipwrights and silversmiths from White Harbour, and fishwives off the stony shore? Are you a true king? John asked suddenly.
I've never had a crown on my head or sat my ass on a bloody throne, if that's what you're asking,
Mance replied.
My birth is as low as a man's can get. No septons ever smeared my head with oils. I don't own any castles, and my queen wears furs and amber, not silk and sapphires. I am my own champion, my own fool, and my own harpist. You don't become king beyond the wall because your father was. The free folk won't follow a name, and they don't care which brother was born first. They follow fighters. When I left the Shadow Tower, there were five men making noises about how they might be the stuff of kings. Tormund was one, the Magnar another. The other three I slew, when they made it plain they'd sooner fight than follow.
You can kill your enemies, John said bluntly, but can you rule your friends? If we let your people pass, are you strong enough to make them keep the king's peace and obey the laws?
Whose laws? The laws of Winterfell and King's Landing?
Mance laughed.
When we want laws, we'll make our own.
You can keep your king's justice, too, and your king's taxes. I'm offering you the horn, not our freedom. We will not kneel to you.
What if we refuse the offer? John had no doubt that they would. The old bear might at least have listened, though he would have balked at the notion of letting 30,000 or 40,000 wildlings loose on the Seven Kingdoms. But Alistair Thorne and Jaina Slint would dismiss the notion out of hand.
"If you refuse," Mance Rayder said, "Tormund Giantsbane will sound the horn of winter 3 days hence, at dawn."
He could carry the message back to Castle Black and tell them of the horn, but if he left Mance still alive, Lord Janus and Sir Alistair would seize on that as proof that he was a turncloak. 1,000 thoughts flickered through John's head. "If I can destroy the horn, smash it here and now." But before he could begin to think that through, he heard the low moan of some other horn, made faint by the tent's hide walls. Mance heard it too. Frowning, he went to the door. John followed. The war horn was louder outside. Its call had stirred the wildling camp. 3 horn-foot men jogged past, carrying long spears. Horses were whinnying and snorting, giants roaring in the old tongue, and even the mammoths were restless.
"Outrider's horn," Tormund told Mance.
"Something's coming."
Varamyr sat cross-legged on the half-frozen ground. His wolves circled restlessly around him. A shadow swept over him, and John looked up to see the eagle's blue-grey wings.
"Coming from the east."
"When the dead walk, walls and stakes and swords mean nothing," he remembered. "You cannot fight the dead, Jon Snow. No man knows that half so well as me."
Harmer scowled. "East, the white should be behind us."
"East," the skin changer repeated. "Something's coming."
"The others?" Jon asked. Mance shook his head.
"The others never come when the sun is up."
Chariots were rattling across the killing ground, jammed with riders waving spears of sharpened bone. The king groaned.
"Where the bloody hell do they think they're going? Quen, get those fools back where they belong. Someone bring me horse. The mare, not the stallion. I'll want me armor, too."
Mance glanced suspiciously at the wall. Atop the ice of parapets, the straw soldiers stood collecting arrows, but there was no sign of any other activity.
"Harmer, mount up your raiders. Tormund, find your sons and give me a triple line of spears."
"Aye," said Tormund, striding off.
The mousy little skin changer closed his eyes and said, "I see them. They're coming along the streams and game trails."
"Who?"
"Men. Men on horses, men in steel, and men in black."
"Crows!"
Mance made the word a curse. He turned on John.
"Did my old brothers think they'd catch me with me breeches down if they attacked while we were talking?"
"If they planned an attack, they never told me about it." John did not believe it. Lord Janus lacked the men to attack the wildling camp. Besides, he was on the wrong side of the wall, and the gate was sealed with rubble. He had a different sort of treachery in mind. This can't be his work.
"If you're lying to me again, you won't be leaving here alive," Mance warned.
His guards brought him his horse and armor. Elsewhere around the camp, John saw people running at cross purposes, some men forming up as if to storm the wall, while others slipped into the woods. Women driving dog carts east, mammoths wandering west. He reached back over his shoulder and drew Longclaw, just as a thin line of rangers emerged from the fringes of the wood 300 yards away. They wore black mail, black half-helms, and black cloaks. Half-armored, Mance drew his sword.
"You knew nothing of this, did you?"
he said to John coldly. Slow as honey on a cold morning, the rangers swept down on the wildling camp, picking their way through clumps of gorse and stands of trees over roots and rocks. Wildlings flew to meet them, shouting war cries and waving clubs and bronze swords, and axes made of flint, galloping headlong at their ancient enemies. A shout, a slash, and a fine brave death. John had heard brothers say of the free folk's way of fighting. "Believe what you will," John told the king beyond the wall, "but I knew nothing of any attack." Harmer thundered past before Mance could reply, riding at the head of 30 raiders. Her standard went before her, a dead dog impaled on a spear, raining blood at every stride. Mance watched as she smashed into the rangers.
"Might be you're telling it true," he said. "Those look like Eastwatch men. Sailors on horses. Cutter Pike always had more guts than sense. He took the Lord of Bones at Longbarrow. He might have thought to do the same with me. If so, he's a fool. He doesn't have the man he—"
"Mance!" The shot came. It was a scout, bursting from the trees on a lathered horse. "Mance, there's more. They're all around us. Iron men! Iron! A host of iron men!" Cursing, Mance swung up into the saddle. "Varamyr, stay, and see that no harm comes to Dala." The king beyond the wall pointed his sword at John.
"And keep a few extra eyes on this crow. If he runs, rip out his throat."
"Aye, I'll do that."
The skin changer was a head shorter than John, slumped and soft, but that shadow cat could disembowel him with one paw.
"They're coming from the north, too,"
Varamyr told Mance.
"You best go."
Mance donned his helm with its raven wings. His men were mounted up as well.
"Arrowhead," Mance snapped. "To me, form wedge."
Yet when he slammed his heels into the mare and flew across the field at the rangers, the men who raced to catch him lost all semblance of formation. John took a step toward the tent, thinking of the Horn of Winter. But the shadow cat blocked him, tail lashing. The beast's nostrils flared, and slaver ran from his curved front teeth. "He smells my fear." He missed Ghost more than ever then. The two wolves were behind him, growling.
"Banners," he heard Varamyr murmur. "I see golden banners. Ooh."
A mammoth lumbered by, trumpeting, a half-dozen bowmen in the wooden tower on its back.
"The king, no!"
Then the skin-changer threw back his head and screamed. The sound was shocking, ear-piercing, thick with agony. Varamyr fell writhing, and the cat was screaming too. And high, high in the eastern sky, against the wall of cloud, John saw the eagle burning. For a heartbeat, it flamed brighter than a star, wreathed in red and gold and orange, its wings beating wildly at the air, as if it could fly from the pain. Higher it flew, and higher still. The scream brought Val out of the tent, white-faced.
"What is it? What's happened?"
Varamyr's wolves were fighting each other, and the shadow cat had raced off into the trees. But the man was still twisting on the ground.
"What's wrong with him?"
Val demanded, horrified.
"Where's Mance?"
"There," John pointed, "gone to fight." The king led his ragged wedge into a knot of rangers, his sword flashing.
"Gone? He can't be gone, not now. It started."
"The battle?" He watched the rangers scatter before Harmer's bloody dog's head. The raiders screamed and hacked and chased the men in black back into the trees. But there were more men coming from the wood, a column of horse. Knights on heavy horse, John saw. Harmer had to regroup and wheel to meet them, but half of her men had raced too far ahead.
"The birth!"
Val was shouting at him. Trumpets were blowing all around, loud and brazen. The wildlings have no trumpets, only war horns. They knew that as well as he did. The sound sent free folk running in confusion, some toward the fighting, others away. A mammoth was stomping through a flock of sheep that three men were trying to herd off west. The drums were beating as the wildlings ran to form squares and lines, but they were too late, too disorganized, too slow. The enemy was emerging from the forest, from the east, the northeast, the north, three great columns of heavy horse, all dark glinting steel and bright wool surcoats. Not the men of Eastwatch. Those had been no more than a line of scouts, an army. The king. John was as confused as the wildlings. Could Rob have returned? Had the boy on the Iron Throne finally bestirred himself? "You'd best get back inside the tent," he told Val. Across the field, one column had washed over Harmer Dog's head. Another smashed into the flank of Tormund's spearmen as he and his sons desperately tried to turn them. The giants were climbing onto their mammoths, though, and the knights on their barded horses did not like that at all. He could see how the coursers and destriers screamed and scattered at the sight of those lumbering mountains. But there was fear on the wildling side as well, hundreds of women and children rushing away from the battle, some of them blundering right under the hooves of Garin's. He saw an old woman's dog cart veer into the path of three chariots to send them crashing into each other. "Guards," Val whispered. "Guards, why are they doing this?" "Go inside the tent and stay with Darla. It's not safe out here." It wouldn't be a great deal safer inside, but she didn't need to hear that.
"I need to find the midwife," Val said.
"You're the midwife. I'll stay here until Mance comes back." He had lost sight of Mance, but now he found him again, cutting his way through a knot of mounted men. The mammoths had shattered the centre column, but the other two were closing like pincers. On the eastern edge of the camps, some archers were loosing fire arrows at the tents. He saw a mammoth pluck a knight from his saddle and fling him 40 feet with a flick of his trunk. Wildlings streamed past, women and children running from the battle, some with men hurrying them along. A few of them gave John dark looks, but Longclaw was in his hand, and no one troubled him. Even Varamyr fled, crawling off on his hands and knees. More and more men were pouring from the trees, not only knights now, but free riders and mounted bowmen and men-at-arms in jacks and kettle helms, dozens of men, hundreds of men. A blaze of banners flew above them. The wind was whipping them too wildly for John to see the sigils, but he glimpsed a seahorse, a field of birds, a ring of flowers, and yellow, so much yellow, yellow banners with a red device. Whose arms were those? East and northeast, he saw bands of wildlings trying to stand and fight, but the attackers rode right over them. The free folk still had the numbers, but the attackers had steel armour and heavy horses. In the thickest part of the fray, John saw Mance standing tall in his stirrups. His red and black cloak and raven-winged helm made him easy to pick out. He had his sword raised, and men were rallying to him, when a wedge of knights smashed into them with lance and sword and long axe. Mance's mare went up on her hind legs, kicking, and a spear took her through the breast. Then the steel tide washed over him. "It's done," John thought. "They're breaking." The wildlings were running, throwing down their weapons. Hornfoot men and cave dwellers and fens in bronze scales, they were running. Mance was gone. Someone was waving Harmer's head on a pole. Tormund's lines had broken. Only the giants on the mammoths were holding, hairy islands in a red steel sea. The fires were leaping from tent to tent, and some of the tall pines were going up as well. And through the smoke, another wedge of armored riders came, on barded horses. Floating above them were the largest banners yet, royal standards as big as sheets, a yellow one with long pointed tongues that showed a flaming heart, and another like a sheet of beaten gold, with a black stag prancing and rippling in the wind. "Robert!" John thought for one mad moment, remembering poor Owen. But when the trumpets blew again and the knights charged, the name they cried was, "Stannis! Stannis! Stannis!" John turned away and went inside the tent. Arya. Outside the inn, on a weathered gibbet, a woman's bones were twisting and rattling at every gust of wind.
"I know this inn."
There hadn't been a gibbet outside the door when she had slept here with her sister Sansa under the watchful eye of Septa Mordain, though. "We don't want to go in," Arya decided suddenly. "There might be ghosts."
"You know how long it's been since I had a cup of wine?" Sandor swung down from the saddle. "Besides, we need to learn who holds the Ruby Ford. Stay with the horses if you want. It's no hair off my arse."
"What if they know you?" Sandor no longer troubled to hide his face. He no longer seemed to care who knew him. "They might want to take you captive."
"Let them try."
He loosened his long sword in its scabbard and pushed through the door. Arya would never have a better chance to escape. She could ride off on Craven and take Stranger too. She chewed her lip. Then she led the horses to the stables and went in after him.
"They know him."
The silence told her that. But that wasn't the worst thing. She knew them too. Not the skinny innkeep, nor the women, nor the field hands by the hearth, but the others, the soldiers. She knew the soldiers.
"Look in for your brother, Sandor."
Polliver's hand was down the bodice of the girl on his lap, but now he slid it out.
"Look in for a cup of wine. Innkeep, a flagon of red."
Clegane threw a handful of cuppers on the floor.
"I don't want no trouble, sir," the innkeep said.
"Then don't call me sir."
His mouth twitched.
"Are you a deaf fool? I ordered wine."
As the man ran off, Clegane shouted after him.
"Two cups. The girl's thirsty too."
"There are only three," Arya thought. Polliver gave her a fleeting glance, and the boy beside him never looked at her at all, but the third one gazed long and hard. He was a man of middling height and build, with a face so ordinary that it was hard to say how old he was. The Tickler. The Tickler and Polliver both. The boy was a squire, judging by his age and dress. He had a big white pimple on one side of his nose, and some red ones on his forehead.
"Is this the lost poppy Sir Gregor spoke of?" he asked the Tickler. "The one who piddled in the rushes and ran off?"
The Tickler put a warning hand on the boy's arm and gave a short, sharp shake of his head. Arya read that plain enough. The squire didn't, or else he didn't care.
"Sir said his poppy brother tucked his tail between his legs when the battle got too warm at King's Landing. He said he ran off, whimpering."
He gave the hound a stupid, mocking grin. Clegane studied the boy and never said a word. Polliver shoved the girl off his lap and got to his feet.
"The lad's drunk," he said.
The man-at-arms was almost as tall as the hound, though not so heavily muscled. A spade-shaped beard covered his jaw and jowls, thick and black and neatly trimmed, but his head was more bald than not.
"He can't hold his wine, is all." "Then he shouldn't drink."
"The puppy doesn't scare,"
the boy began, till the Tickler casually twisted his ear between thumb and forefinger. The words became a squeal of pain. The innkeep came scurrying back with two stone cups and a flagon on a pewter platter. Sandor lifted the flagon to his mouth. Arya could see the muscles in his neck working as he gulped. When he slammed it back down on the table, half the wine was gone.
"Now you can pour. Best pick up those cuppers, too. It's the only coin you'll like to see today."
"We'll pay when we've done drinking," said Polliver. "When you're done drinking, you'll tickle the innkeep to see where he keeps his gold, the way you always do."
The innkeep suddenly remembered something in the kitchen. The locals were leaving too, and the girls were gone. The only sound in the common room was the faint crackling of the fire in the hearth. "We should go too," Arya knew.
"If you're looking for sir, you've come too late," Polliver said. "He was at Harrenhal, but now he's not. The queen sent for him."
He wore three blades on his belt, Arya saw, a long sword on his left hip, and on his right a dagger and a slimmer blade, too long to be a dirk and too short to be a sword.
"King Joffrey's dead, you know," he added, "poisoned at his own wedding feast."
Arya edged further into the room. Joffrey's dead. She could almost see him with his blonde curls and his mean smile and his fat, soft lips. Joffrey's dead? She knew it ought to make her happy, but somehow she still felt empty inside. Joffrey was dead, but if Rob was dead too, what did it matter? "So much for my brave brothers of the King's Guard," the Hound gave a snort of contempt. "Who killed him?" "The imp, it's thought. Him and his little wife."
"What wife?"
"Oh, I forgot. You've been hiding under a rock. The northern girl, Winterfell's daughter. We heard she killed the king with a spell and afterward changed into a wolf with big leather wings like a bat and flew out a tower window. But she left the dwarf behind, and Cersei means to have his head." "That's stupid," Arya thought. "Sansa only knows songs, not spells, and she'd never marry the imp." The Hound sat on the bench closest the door. His mouth twitched, but only the burn side. "She ought to dip him in wildfire and cook him, or tickle him till the moon turns black." He raised his wine cup and drained it straight away. "He's one of them," Arya thought when she saw that. She bit her lip so hard she tasted blood. "He's just like they are. I should kill him when he sleeps." "So, Gregor took Arryn-hell," Sandor said. "Didn't require much taking," said Polliver. "The sellswords fled as soon as they knew we were coming, all but a few. One of the kooks opened a postern gate for us to get back at Hoot for cutting off his foot." He chuckled. "We kept him to cook for us, a couple of wenches to warm our beds, and put all the rest to the sword."
"All the rest?" Arya blurted out.
"Well, Sir kept Hoot to pass the time." Sandor said, "The Blackfish is still in River Run?" "Not for long," said Polliver. "He's under siege. Old Frey's going to hang Edmure Tully unless he yields the castle. The only real fighting's around Raventree, Blackwoods and Brackens. The Brackens are ours now."
The Hound poured a cup of wine for Arya and another for himself, and drank it down while staring at the hearth fire.
"The little bird flew away, did she? Well, bloody good for her. She shit on the imp's head and flew off."
"They'll find her," said Polliver, "if it takes half the golden Casterly rook." "A pretty girl, I hear," said the tickler. "Honey sweet."
He smacked his lips and smiled.
"And courteous," the Hound agreed. "A proper little lady, not like her bloody sister."
"They found her, too," said Polliver. "The sister. She's for Bolton's bastard, I hear."
Arya sipped her wine so they could not see her mouth. She didn't understand what Polliver was talking about.
"Sansa has no other sister?"
Sandor Clegane laughed aloud.
"What's so bloody funny?" asked Polliver.
The Hound never flicked an eye at Arya.
"If I'd wanted you to know, I'd have told you. Are there ships at Saltpans?"
"Saltpans? How should I know? The traders are back at Maidenpool, I heard. Randall Tarley took the castle and locked Mouton in a tower cell. I haven't heard shit about Saltpans."
The tickler leaned forward.
"Would you put to sea without bidding farewell to your brother?"
It gave Arya chills to hear him ask a question.
"Sir would sooner you return to Harrenhal with us, Sander." "I bet he would. Or King's Landing."
"Bugger that. Bugger him. Bugger you."
The tickler shrugged, straightened, and reached a hand behind his head to rub the back of his neck. Everything seemed to happen at once then. Sandor lurched to his feet. Polliver drew his longsword, and the tickler's hand whipped around in a blur to send something silver flashing across the common room. If the Hound had not been moving, the knife might have cored the apple of his throat. Instead, it only grazed his ribs and wound up quivering in the wall near the door. He laughed then, a laugh as cold and hollow as if it had come from the bottom of a deep well.
"I was hoping you'd do something stupid."
His sword slid from its scabbard just in time to knock aside Polliver's first cut.
Arya took a step backward as the long steel song began. The tickler came off the bench with a short sword in one hand and a dagger in the other. Even the chunky brown-haired squire was up, fumbling for his sword hilt. She snatched her wine cup off the table and threw it at his face. Her aim was better than it had been at the twins. The cup hit him right on his big white pimple, and he went down hard on his tail. Polliver was a grim, methodical fighter, and he pressed Sandor steadily backward, his heavy longsword moving with brutal precision. The hound's own cuts were sloppier, his parries rushed, his feet slow and clumsy. "He's drunk," Arya realized with dismay. "He drank too much too fast, with no food in his belly." And the tickler was sliding around the wall to get behind him. She grabbed the second wine cup and flung it at him, but he was quicker than the squire had been and ducked his head in time. The look he gave her then was cold with promise. "Is there gold hidden in the village?" she could hear him ask. The stupid squire was clutching the edge of a table and pulling himself to his knees. Arya could taste the beginnings of panic in the back of her throat. Fear cuts deeper than swords. Fear cuts deeper. Sandor gave a grunt of pain. The burn side of his face ran red from temple to cheek, and the stub of his ear was gone. That seemed to make him angry. He drove Polliver back with a furious attack, hammering at him with the old Nick longsword he had swapped for in the hills. The bearded man gave way, but none of the cuts so much as touched him. And then the tickler leapt over a bench quick as a snake and slashed at the back of the hound's neck with the edge of his short sword. "They're killing him." Arya had no more cups, but there was something better to throw. She drew the dagger they'd robbed off the dying archer and tried to fling it at the tickler the way he'd done. It wasn't the same as throwing a rock or a crabapple, though. The knife wobbled and hit him in the arm, hilt first. He never even felt it. He was too intent on Clegane. As he stabbed, Clegane twisted violently aside, winning himself half a heartbeat's respite. Blood ran down his face and from the gash in his neck. Both of the mountain's men came after him hard, Polliver hacking at his head and shoulders while the tickler darted in to stab at back and belly. The heavy stone flagon was still on the table. Arya grabbed it with both hands. But as she lifted it, someone grabbed her arm. The flagon slipped from her fingers and crashed to the floor. Wrenched around, she found herself nose to nose with the squire. "You stupid, you forgot all about him." His big white pimple had burst, she saw.
"Are you the puppy's puppy?"
He had his sword in his right hand and her arm in his left. But her own hands were free, so she jerked his knife from its sheath and sheathed it again in his belly, twisting. He wasn't wearing mail or even boiled leather, so it went right in, the same way Needle had when she killed the stable boy at King's Landing. The squire's eyes got big, and he let go of her arm. Arya spun to the door and wrenched the tickler's knife from the wall. Polliver and the tickler had driven the hound into a corner behind a bench, and one of them had given him an ugly red gash on his upper thigh to go with his other wounds. Sandor was leaning against the wall, bleeding and breathing noisily. He looked as though he could barely stand, let alone fight.
"Throw down the sword, and we'll take you back to Harrenhal," Polliver told him. "So Gregor can finish me himself?"
The tickler said,
"Maybe he'll give you to me. If you want me, come and get me."
Sandor pushed away from the wall and stood in a half-crouch behind the bench, his sword held across his body.
"You think we won't?" said Polliver. "You're drunk." "Might be," said the hound, "but you're dead."
His foot lashed out and caught the bench, driving it hard into Polliver's shins. Somehow the bearded man kept his feet, but the hound ducked under his wild slash and brought his own sword up in a vicious backhand cut. Blood spattered on the ceiling and walls. The blade caught in the middle of Polliver's face, and when the hound wrenched it loose, half his head came with it. The tickler backed away. Arya could smell his fear. The short sword in his hand seemed almost a toy against the long blade the hound was holding, and he wasn't armored either. He moved swiftly, light on his feet, never taking his eyes off Sandor Clegane. It was the easiest thing in the world for Arya to step up behind him and stab him.
"'Is there gold hidden in the village?' she shouted as she drove the blade up through his back. "'Is there silver? Gems?' she stabbed twice more. "'Is there food? Where is Lord Beric?' She was on top of him by then, still stabbing. "'Where did he go? How many men were with him? How many knights? How many bowmen? How many? How many? How many? How many? How many? How many? How many?